Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
And today we're discussing mortgage news, spending trends, and pumpkin spice.
That's right, Joel. This is our Friday episode, our Friday flight, where we talk about a lot of different headlines that were in the news this week. And we like to talk about them specifically in how they pertain to our money, how it affects our personal finances. So I'm excited to get to the topics that you mentioned, plus a few more. But first, man, this has been the first week of virtual schooling for our kids.
Yeah, for a lot of people on the East Coast, which led to massive Zoom problems on Monday morning.
Monday morning, 9 o'clock hit and Zoom was down.
At least a lot of people freaking out, teachers, school systems, parents, all alike, just kind of scrambling essentially to figure out how they're going to connect to one another.
I will say, I feel like our teachers did a good job. Like before,
incredible job.
Yeah, we were on there early and one of our kids was able to get on, but the other kid was not. And before 9 o'clock hit, we had already had a message out and the teachers were switching over to Google Meet, which, by the way, in my opinion, is inferior to Zoom. Do you have a preference actually on those two?
I don't use them enough really to know. I wouldn't say. So I'm just glad Zoom got it back together. Yeah. It seems like it's working really well now. Just a full-fledged outage Monday morning, but they're, you know, back to normal by that afternoon.
Totally. Well, I'll say that I prefer Zoom because I want to share why. And it's specifically because when you're muted, you can just hit the space bar to talk.
Oh.
I didn't know that until my second grader taught me that. I, like you, don't have, we don't use Zoom all that often. I mean, very rarely. A lot of the conference calls I have been on Google Meet. So yeah, I'm not versed when it comes to Zoom. And Evie was like, no, Daddy, all you have to do is hit the space bar and it unmutes it. You talk. And so it's like a walkie-talkie or like an intercom.
That is nice to not have to find the button on your screen and click it.
Yeah. Or even do like the fancy command, which I was doing before. Like, yeah, it's like command D or I don't know, command U or something like that. Kind of unmutes it on a Mac. Spacebar, man, that's all you need if you're on the next Zoom call.
Much better.
Boom.
All right, let's get to our Friday flight, Matt. The stories that we found interesting this week. And you wanted to talk about pumpkin spice.
I love them.
Do you really?
Not really.
Okay.
It's been years since I have gotten, I mean, literally, I think it's been years since I've gotten a flavored Starbucks drink. But I used to be a fan of the caramel frappuccino. Like in the summer, you know, they drizzle that caramel all over the top.
I'm more orange mocha frappuccino over here.
Of course you are.
Zoolander reference.
Blue steel. But it is PSL season, man. You know, Halloween decorations and pumpkin spice lattes, they both feel like that they are being sold a little earlier every year. And for the sugar-laden coffee drink, this past Tuesday was actually the earliest that they have been released. But we're not here to necessarily hate on pumpkin spice latte. If that's your thing, you know, if that's your craft beer equivalent, then enjoy. But like we mentioned on Wednesday's episode, if you're picking up expensive coffee drinks, primarily due to convenience, you are paying a high fee. This could be one of the ways that your habits are parting you from your hard-earned money.
Yeah, I love Halloween. It's one of my favorite holidays. Actually, like our street and our neighborhood in general, like we're basically super into Halloween. And
yeah,
the street I live on gets crazy.
Yeah.
I'm really interested.
People know. We've talked about it before.
Yeah. I'm interested to see what it's going to be like this year, though, with COVID. Like, you know, you wear masks typically with a Halloween costume, so maybe that'll keep things going. But I don't know.
Everybody's a ninja.
Exactly. But yeah, I don't really take to the fall drinks and pumpkin spice. Pumpkin in general is just not my jam. But I agree, Matt. If it's an intentional choice to buy a drink that we love, then it's cool. And if not, then we're wasting money. We're watching dollars slip away based on convenience spending as opposed to something that we've intentionally decided to prioritize in our lives. And then, you know, the rule of 173 kind of comes into play here. That's where you take a monthly expense and you multiply it by 173 to basically roughly figure out how much money you'd have in 10 years if you invested that money instead. And I think that can be a solid exercise for people to determine whether they want to prioritize spending on something like pumpkin spice lattes or pumpkin flavored beers even, which are also not my jam.
Man, you're such a pumpkin hater.
I'm like the Scrooge of Halloween.
I don't love pumpkin, but man, like a nice pumpkin bread or a pumpkin pie, like you don't like any of that kind of stuff?
It's okay. I like pumpkin seeds.
Oh. That's because they don't taste like pumpkin.
Yeah.
It's like I like things that are crunchy and salty.
Exactly.
It sounds like I bet you also love potato chips.
I do. That's good.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah. But no, pumpkin flavor is not, I'm not really into it.
All right. So maybe a quick example to help illustrate the rule of 173 for folks. Let's say you swing by Starbucks a couple times a week and you spend, say, $5 on a pumpkin spice latte. That's about how much they cost if you kind of go with a medium-sized one. And then maybe you spend a couple bucks too on like a bagel.
I believe that's a venti sized.
No, ventis are like $6.
Then it's grande, or I don't know. I don't know their naming convention.
Yeah, it's either small, medium, or large. Like that's how the rest of the world works. We're not
I don't think they respond to you at the counter if you order like that.
I don't know. It just depends who you get. They might kind of snobbishly look at you and be like, that's called a tall. But you could easily spend, say, $7 a visit, right? Plus tax and tip. You could easily spend $15 a week. So you do the math on that. That equals $60 a month. Multiply that out by 173. You're looking at over $10,000 were you to invest that money, right? So your Starbucks habit could be costing you $10,000 over the long run, over 10 years. And that's not to say, again, like you said, Joel, it's not something that we want people to avoid doing. If that's something you love, by all means, make sure to do it. I mean, we're not going to do the math on the amount of money that we'd be able to save if we didn't drink beer, because I'm sure it would be an incredibly large number.
And it's not worth it in the end for us to stop.
It's worth it for us to buy it and to have this enjoyment in our lives. But we just are wanting to point out that this is real money, you know, because a lot of times people say, oh, you know, cutting out lattes, that doesn't really move the needle. But when you do the math, it really does move the needle to a certain extent.
Yeah, and I think, you know, personal finance experts have used the latte as kind of this line of demarcation to a certain extent. I feel like that and avocado toast have become like the two hot things where if millennials would stop spending on these things, then everyone would be okay and we'd have more money. And that's just not true. Like there are much bigger issues at play in the financial lives of millennials. But it doesn't mean that mindless spending is okay and is a good idea for us to participate in. Right?
Especially you take that mindless spending and then you multiply it by other little areas where you spend without even really thinking about it, right?
Exactly.
Like, as those things accumulate and build up, like that's where it can seriously have a big impact on your money.
Yeah, exactly. All right, Matt, let's get on to some more stuff. Last week, you and I, we shared how Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac were going to start charging lenders an additional 0.5% fee on mortgage refis. Well, psych, it's not happening, at least for the time being. And there's kind of good news and bad news here. The bad news is that the fee is going to happen, but it's not actually going to be implemented until December, as opposed to September, which is like right around the corner. But that fee, at least for the time being, is still slated to happen, which could cost the average person who's doing a refinance maybe like an extra $1,500, which is a lot of money. I think the delay of that fee does incentivize people who have been thinking about refinancing to actually maybe get off their butt and start proceeding quickly so that they can avoid that additional fee and also lock in some of the incredibly low rates that are out there right now.
That's right. So that's delayed. That's good news. And a little bit more of the good news too, that, you know, that extra fee that will not be charged on any refis that are for loans that are less than $125,000, which is great. And it also won't be charged on Home Ready and Home Possible loans either. So this is all great for smaller refi amounts as well as lower income borrowers.
All right, Matt, let's keep talking about mortgages. There's apparently a new form floating around when people are getting a mortgage right now. And the lender is actually asking the person who's doing the borrowing to forsake the possibility of forbearance in the future. Many mortgage services are creating this new form that asks borrowers to certify that they haven't applied for forbearance from any mortgage payments in the past, and they have no plans to ask for it. You and I, Matt, we've talked about lenders tightening their standards for borrowers, including requiring more money down, scrutinizing your credit score more intently. But signing a commitment to avoid seeking forbearance is like this new crummy wrinkle in the mortgage game. I don't like seeing that. They're asking for this essentially hard commitment that you're not going to need help at some point.
Yeah, you know, I'm actually curious if those forms are going to have any teeth, you know, because like
sort of legal standing.
Exactly, because you could say that like, oh no, I wasn't planning to, but now I am in a situation where I need to do that. That's something we'll keep an eye on. But if you are in the process of buying a home, you know, definitely keep an eye out for one of those new, you know, COVID-19 borrower certification forms. That's what they're called. Be sure that you understand what you're signing if they are going to make you sign it. If I was in that situation, I would even want to know ahead of time if a document like that was going to be at the closing table. It might even be worth shopping around with additional lenders to ensure that you do have access to those forbearance protections. You know, we've seen how handy those protections have been for a lot of individuals. I think maybe at the beginning of this pandemic, most folks were thinking, oh, I'm going to be fine. But we've heard from a lot of folks who, you know, they've lost a job or they've had their, you know, their wages cut dramatically. And that means they're in a position to where it's a struggle to pay their mortgage. So I think a lot of folks have been surprised that they've been in a position, you know, where they have needed that forbearance.
Yeah, Matt. Well, on that note, a lot of people did experience pay cuts in the beginning of the pandemic, but there have been some stories floating around this week that pay cut restoration is happening, that a lot of the people who did take a, let's say, 10 or 20% pay cut at their job, they're starting to get their full pay reinstated, which is great to see, especially because things are still so uncertain in regards to the pandemic. But the economy is experiencing a little bit of stability right now. And of course, employees are excited to see that their company is doing okay and has the ability to reinstate that pay. And it's so good for their personal bottom line at the same time. The Wall Street Journal reported that Yelp, which laid off 1,000 workers and furloughed more than 1,100 other workers in the spring, well, they're bringing back nearly all of their furloughed staffers, and they are going to fully restore employee pay and hours. So it's good to see there's so many different examples of companies who are struggling mightily, and their companies doing better than anticipated. Just kind of 6 months into the pandemic and its economic effects, they're able to kind of start getting back to a little bit of normalcy in regards to employee pay.
Yeah, another example, General Motors, they reduced pay of 69,000 workers by 20% with a promise to pay that money back with interest by spring of 2021. But they're speeding that up. That repayment process is happening this year. You know, they say that they're going to have money back in workers' hands by the end of this year, which is really cool to see. You know, these moves are acknowledging that it's really tough to continue working full time and not receive the pay that these individuals signed up for when they were hired. You know, especially too, given the additional responsibilities of parents who are oftentimes facilitating online learning for kids. And so hopefully this is a trend we continue to see as businesses are getting back on their feet, that we are able to see normal pay resume.
All right, Matt, there was a whole lot more that happened this week, including some really interesting stats about online shopping. We'll get to that and more right after this break.
All right, Joel, we're back from the break, and before we dive into some spending trends, where we're going to talk about e-commerce, a quick update on stimulus checks. You know, we've previously mentioned the potential for an additional $1,200, but that was something that would have likely been included in an extension of the CARES Act or the new proposed HEALS or HEROES Act. But, you know, since the Senate isn't scheduled to return to D.C. until September, even if a new bill does get passed, and even if stimulus checks are included, it'll likely be maybe October before any of us see any of those additional stimulus dollars. We wanted to mention that because we don't want folks to necessarily, you know, count on that money. We don't want folks spending that money before they actually have it, right? We don't want folks to count their chickens before they hatch.
I never, ever count my chickens before they hatch.
Never done it.
And I never will.
Even when we did have backyard chickens, never actually counted those chickens. Well, we never hatched any. We just got the actual chickens from a farm.
Well, then you wouldn't have to count them.
We didn't have a rooster. That's, you know, that's how it works.
Yeah, that's true. That's a good point. Are we going to go birds and bees here with this?
Let's do it.
All right. Yeah, well,
maybe next time.
I think too, especially when we're talking about Congress or political movement and believing that something's going to happen before we actually physically see it in reality, it's an even better idea to wait and to not sort of take any sort of action or start spending money that we haven't seen, because I still think something will happen at some point, but the timeline is just all screwed up at this point. But on to some other news, Matt. Let's talk about e-commerce and online spending. And e-commerce, as you would expect in a pandemic where we're all essentially staying at home a whole lot more, it's kicking butt. And U.S. e-commerce sales rose 32% in quarter two, of course, in large part due to the fact that we're staying out of brick and mortar stores a whole lot more than usual. But that spike in online sales meant that e-commerce grew as much in the past 3 months as it had in the previous 5 years.
That's crazy.
Yeah, it's like an acceleration of this trend that was already happening, but it's like one of those fancy Teslas where you go to 0 to 60 in 2 seconds. it's happening so much quicker than it normally would.
E-commerce has hit ludicrous mode.
Exactly. So much of that also is due to the kind of the click and collect that some of the bigger companies are doing, like Target and Walmart, allowing you to buy online and then have a easy pickup in the parking lot. That has inflated the online sales, but all it kind of creates this in-between path for people to use in order to grab their goods. And a lot of small businesses are setting up online shops in record numbers too right now. Shopify is a company that hosts e-commerce websites. They saw a 71% increase in new online stores in the second quarter compared to a year earlier. So small businesses are rapidly moving to shift and trying to take advantage of where customers are moving, which is to do more online shopping.
Yeah, I saw another story too where Best Buy, they're turning like a quarter of all of their stores into like these new like super shipping hubs,
yeah,
where they're able to accommodate more online orders. But, you know, just because this is good for the economy and we're seeing e-commerce increase, that doesn't necessarily mean that that's good for us as individuals when it comes to our spending, you know? And so something interesting to keep in mind is like whether or not this trend will continue, because it's, you know, yet to be seen here in the US, but something that is really interesting is that in the UK, they have seen their e-commerce levels remain really high, even while lockdown efforts have eased and in-person sales and commerce have returned back to normal levels. You know, granted, this might be due to pent-up demand. Maybe a lot of folks are buying new gear for the school year, you know, laptops. There's a laptop shortage as well. But this could be a bad sign for us as individual savers. You know, we might find ourselves dramatically overspending as we've really gotten used to online ordering and we're doing it more. We're addicted, you know, while we resume our in-person spending as well. It's something for us to look out for and to monitor, you know, as we do resume in-person spending.
Yeah, we've heard from a lot of people, too, who are a little more bored these days and maybe just more likely to emotionally spend online. And there are important ways that you can, you know, curb some of that unhealthy emotional spending, including, you know, unsubscribing from certain company emails that might trigger you to spend, or, you know, stop following some people on Instagram who are constantly trying to sell you things. And also, you know, we're big fans, Matt, of instituting like a 24 or a 48 hour rule. So, and when you see something that you're interested in buying, you know, put it in the cart, but don't actually purchase, and then wait at least 24 hours before you do. Oftentimes you'll find that your desire for that item has cooled and you're not going to follow through with that purchase. And I think now more than ever, it's really important to kind of institute some of those barriers into our lives so that we don't overspend and overconsume.
And let's talk about faith-based health plans, man. I've been actually rolling with one of these health-sharing organizations for a few years now for medical coverage for my family. And for us, man, it's worked out really great. But I also fully understood the limitations of that coverage when I signed up. It's not technically or legally insurance, like what you can find on healthcare.gov, even though it does behave and perform a lot like insurance. But the reason that, you know, that we went with one of these plans and that a lot of people opt for these health sharing plans over traditional insurance is because of the huge cost savings. For us, man, it's at least $500 a month. And that's actually from a couple years ago. I haven't recently gotten health insurance quotes, but it could be even more expensive now, which, you know, means that we would be saving even more money at the moment.
Yeah, because health insurance prices don't tend to go down.
Sky high, especially if you are self-employed. You know, and so that comes, though, with a trade-off going with these plans. It often means that you have limited benefits. So, for example, you know, we pay for wellness visits out of pocket. It's something that we are aware of. We know about it. And then we plan accordingly. I feel like that's when people can kind of get into a tough situation, is when they don't know exactly what it does and doesn't cover.
Yeah. If you have a health sharing plan, you essentially have to be more willing to self-insure and pay more things out of pocket as like an exchange for that highly reduced
exactly
premium amount, right? And I put premiums in quotes because they're not really premiums either, because it's not real insurance. And there is a new proposal. The reason we're talking about this, there's a new proposal that would allow faith-based plans to be considered insurance, which means that these monthly contributions, they're not premiums, would get a tax break. But that just, it's so interesting to me that this is happening, because insurance companies are subject to state regulation, but health sharing ministries, they're allowed to exist without this added oversight, in large part due to the fact that they're not selling health insurance. So this feels kind of ill-conceived. It's almost trying to bring something into the fold that is purposefully supposed to be set apart and completely different to provide a unique service for people that want something different than traditional health insurance.
Yeah, it's pretty weird, man. You know, we've been served well by our health sharing plan. I even wrote an article about it over on the site that we'll link to. But they don't work well for everyone, you know, like folks with pre-existing conditions. They likely shouldn't even consider them. But it will be interesting to see, you know, how things do pan out, because if we have the ability to deduct our monthly contributions like insurance premiums, like, I'm going to be all for that. However, that might set these plans up to be regulated like traditional insurance plans, which they plainly claim not to be. So I think a lot of the nuance of this discussion will come down to whether or not health sharing plans just get the deduction, or if they are officially labeled as insurance. Because they, you know, like we said, they're clearly not insurance, but I could see if they wanted to pass some of those tax deductions on to health sharing customers. So yeah, it's interesting. I definitely am going to be following along. And yeah, if there's any real updates there, we'll make sure to keep folks posted.
Yeah, for sure. All right, Matt. that. Lastly, let's talk about credit cards. And our advice has always been to not cancel credit cards whenever possible, because it adversely affects your credit score. And your credit score obviously has this wide-ranging impact. So keeping that credit score high is just a huge part of having solid personal finances. And it's really important to note now that you should be attempting to keep your credit card lines, all of them, open. And I think credit card holders are facing like a specific challenge right now, as let's say you have a credit card that the rewards are mostly bent towards travel.
But you're not doing much of that these days.
You're not. And you're like, I'm just not getting enough usage out of this card. It doesn't make sense for me to have this card that has an annual fee when I'm not traveling and I'm not using those rewards and I'm not trying to rack up more travel rewards. And maybe you are. Maybe you're still using it and you're trying to save up for travel in 2021 or 2022, but you're in all likelihood not going anytime soon. And you might be tempted to cancel that card, but that is not the best move for you. And cards like the Chase Sapphire Reserve, which typically specialize in travel rewards, well, they've actually stepped up their game, allowing grocery and gas station purchases to qualify for the $300 annual travel credit through the end of this year. And reward points are worth 50% more on grocery, dining, and home improvement purchases. So these cards are catering their rewards to how people are currently spending. And that helps make that card more relevant to how you're spending. It makes you more likely to continue to use it. But at the same time, if it's not working for you, you might not want to actually fully cancel it all the way.
Angel, while we're talking about specific credit cards, a quick note on grocery rewards. You know, if you found yourself spending more at the grocery store because you're eating out less, the best card is still the Amex Blue Cash Preferred Card. This is one that we've been using nonstop lately. You get 6% back at the grocery store, and not only just on groceries, but on streaming services as well. And, you know, for better or worse, more people are doing that as well.
They're top tier categories that people are thinking about right now.
Seriously. And so if you don't feel like you're getting value, you know, out of your annual fee credit card, we want you to know, too, that you can call and ask for a lower annual fee or a waiver of the fee for this year. A report showed that almost 3/4 of people who have called and requested something similar have received a break. Another option, you could also ask to downgrade your card to another card that your credit card company offers that doesn't have an annual fee. This won't hurt your credit score and allows you to avoid those annual fees for a card that isn't working for you where you aren't receiving those benefits. And by the way, Joel, when you downgrade your credit card, this keeps your score healthy in two ways. One, because it's not a hard inquiry, and so you're not asking for new credit. And two, your history of credit. When you downgrade a card, you're able to keep the previous history that you had with that card. And collectively, that's 25% of your credit score. So that makes a pretty big difference.
Yeah, and if you decided instead to cancel, you're cutting the history off right then and there. And
right.
You're also, you know, lowering the utilization rate. So it's a big difference between canceling a card and downgrading. And we would recommend, like, yeah, either calling in, asking for that waiver of a fee or downgrading. But do not cancel the card. I know a lot of people are thinking about that now. Don't do it.
Well, unless you have a spending problem.
Yes, that's true. That's a good point.
It's hard to dive into all the nuances here, but you know, if you want to keep your credit score really healthy these days, which most folks want to do, but especially if you're looking to, you know, refi or you're a home buyer, you want to keep your score in a good spot. But if you're having issues with credit card spending, then, you know, that might be a step that you do need to take to remove that temptation from you.
That's a good point. Yeah. That's a good point. All right, that's going to do it for this episode. Matt, we'll have show notes for this episode up on our website at howtomoney.com.
And if you haven't already, we would be incredibly thankful if you were to leave us a review over at Apple Podcasts. Make sure you subscribe wherever it is that you listen to podcasts. That keeps our show going and growing as well. So Joel, that's going to be it, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.